by campus. He's here to give the Lyle Lanier Lecture in Psychology. The main sponsor is the Department of Psychology. It's an annual lecture, has taken place for a number of years on the campus. It honors Lyle Lanier, who at one time was head of the psychology department. And we're pleased that he could be here with us and give us a little bit of time as well, talk about the same ideas, bring them to an audience outside of Champaign-Urbana. As we talk, you're certainly welcome to call if you have questions. All we ask of callers is that people try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along and accommodate as many different people as possible. Anyone, of course, though, is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That means anywhere you're listening, Chicago, Southern Illinois, Western Indiana, any place else the signal will travel, you're welcome to use the toll-free line if you'd like to call. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, my pleasure. Great. Fun to be here.
I guess the jumping off point for this research, your concern and the concern of many others in looking at how African-American students perform in college and trying to get at some explanation of the fact that they perform less well than white students and others, particularly in cases where when you look at their background and their ability, you should expect that they should perform better. There have been various kinds of explanations offered. People have said, well, perhaps it has something to do with their preparation before college. Maybe it has to do with their high school experience. Maybe it has to do with attitudes towards education that they might have grown up with. But somehow those kinds of explanations are just unsatisfactory. They don't really do it. And so you and some of your colleagues started looking at something different, and that is this idea of stereotyping, particularly something that you call stereotype threat. So maybe we can start there. What is stereotype threat?
That's a good introduction. We did get interested in, I got interested first in understanding this problem of underachievement among minority students, and it's through the just attempt to grapple with that problem that this concept of stereotype threat emerged. At this point, it's important to stress that stereotype threat is a very general phenomenon. I think everybody experiences it. It's simply the experience of being in a situation where a negative stereotype about a group that you're a part of becomes relevant to something you're doing or to you as a person. At that moment, you sense that you could be judged or treated in terms of the stereotype, or that you might do something inadvertently that would confirm this negative stereotype of this group. And if you care about the thing you're doing, the prospect of being reduced to a stereotype like that can be upsetting and distracting, and right there in the middle of what it is you're doing, it can disturb you and interfere with your performance. As I say, it's something that happens to everybody. I can't think of a group on earth that doesn't have some kind of negative stereotype about it. You know, the old, the young, Methodist, Baptist, professors, students, there are negative stereotypes. And when you're in a, you know, white males, when you're in a situation where a stereotype about that group becomes applicable, you are aware you could be reduced to it, and it's upsetting. We have come to think that that process plays a role in the achievement of minority students, or in any group whose abilities are negatively stereotyped, whose intellectual cognitive abilities are negatively stereotyped. In fact, our work really began looking at the role stereotype threat plays in women's performance in quantitative fields, mathematics, natural sciences, and so on. So probably the bulk of the research actually being done in the field on stereotype threat these days looks at the role this process plays in the performance of women who are in quantitative fields.
And I think we should probably draw some distinction, and in my mind it's a little bit difficult for me make sure I understand the difference between this and what we might call self-fulfilling prophecy, because we also know that if, as an individual goes along in life, if you give him or her a series of messages, direct or indirect, that you're just not going to be successful, that some people at least eventually will begin to believe that, they will absorb that into their being, and in fact they will not be successful. And perhaps that, that's completely apart from their innate ability. It's just that we have pounded into them the idea that they're going to fail. This, though, is different.
That's right. That's a good, I like that question because it enables me to make an important distinction. I think people do often reduce this phenomenon to something like a self-fulfilling prophecy that these groups, for example, women have lived in a society that doesn't think well of their mathematical abilities and skills, and that over time they internalize this and begin to hold low expectations for themselves in the domain of math and quantitative areas, and that is what it is, the self-fulfillment of that lower expectation that is causing the underperformance. And I have to stress that I believe that phenomenon does happen, that there is such a thing as an internalized expectancy which results in a kind of self-fulfilling underperformance. But stereotype threat is something different in the sense that it's just simply being in a situation where you know you could be judged in accord with a negative stereotype of some sort. You can think of stereotype threat as almost a subtype of a kind of reputational threat. I mean, suppose the listener might imagine someone who thinks negatively of them in some particular way, an aunt who thinks that they talk too much or that they don't bring enough to Thanksgiving dinner or something, that some kind of reputation that they might have in the eyes of other people. When they're in a situation where that they could be judged in terms of that reputation, they can start to feel uncomfortable. And if that stereotype threat is just a simple case where that reputation is lodged in the societal stereotype in general, and so members of groups for whom the stereotype is about can feel that kind of pressure in situations where that stereotype is relevant. They could have very strong expectations about their skills in that area and be very achieved. And in fact, one of the surprising features of our research is that stereotype threat is actually felt most acutely by people who often have the strongest personal expectations for themselves in the domain where the stereotype is relevant. It's the woman student who is really good at math, who is likely to feel the pain and the upset about the prospect of being seen through the lens of a gender stereotype in that domain. She's the one that's going to be upset by it. It's a woman who feels less interested in math or less identified with the domain is the term we use. Whether she's stereotyped there or not isn't that important because she doesn't care about the whole domain that much. So stereotype threat is something that's often felt by people who have the strongest personal expectations for themselves in the domain.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the studies that you did to try to test these ideas, so you can understand what was going on. And apparently one of the first things that you did was you took two groups of students, white students and black students, that you had determined were, in terms of their ability, were pretty much the same. Mm-hmm. And you then gave them the same test. And you started out with two groups, white students and black students, and you told them that this is a test that tests your abilities. So here we have a group of students that we think pretty much are the same in terms of their abilities, but we've really made the point that what this is about is getting at your abilities. We give them the same test. Mm-hmm. What happens?
Yeah, it's our theory argues that that's a very different situation for an African-American student compared to a white student. And the difference in the situation, the test is the same, the person administering the test is the same, the temperature in the room is the same. But for the black student, when they experience frustration on that test, there is, in our particular society, a stereotype about their ability that that frustration could be confirming. And it puts them then at risk of being seen in terms of this racial stereotype about intellectual ability, or being at risk of somehow confirming the stereotype. For the white student, the test can be equally frustrating, but that there isn't a negative stereotype out there at all about the group's ability. If anything, there's probably a slightly positive stereotype there about the group's ability. So the difference between the two students, the white and the black student, in this test situation is that for the one, that when that frustration occurs, there is the relevance of this negative stereotype. And for those students in that group, those black students who are really identified with doing well, the prospect of being seen that way is going to be distracting and disturbing, and we predict that their performance will go down in that situation, and indeed it does. So even though we know we've equated them for their skill level coming into that situation, they underperform in that situation.
And then if you do a similar sort of test, you take essentially another two groups of students, black students, white students, roughly the same. You give them the same test, but you tell them something different. You don't tell them this is a test of your ability. You tell them it's a test of problem solving or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you take that sort of pressure off. Then you do the same thing. You give them a test. Then what happens?
Then their performance goes up, and that's probably the real critical piece of evidence in our program of research, is that you can remove this underperformance by setting the test up in such a way as to make the stereotype about race, the racial stereotype about ability, irrelevant to their performance on the same test. Very importantly, you're giving them the same test, but this time you've told them that this is not a test of ability. The racial stereotype is about intellectual ability, so it becomes relevant when a test is about ability. You make the stereotype irrelevant when you tell them this performance is not a measure of individual ability. It's an instrument we use to study problem solving in general in our laboratory. Please do the best you can and so on, but it's not a test of your ability in this area at all. Well, under that condition, as the black students experience frustration, that stereotype about their group is not relevant to this particular performance. It's just not relevant because this isn't a test of ability, and so the stereotype about ability isn't relevant. When you can create that situation, as we do in the laboratory, this is something I'm not sure you can do at home in real-life testing situations. We'll get to that question later. But when you do that, their performance goes up and matches then the performance of equally skilled white students. Mm.
So this in this situation, what you've done is it is a hard test. You want it to be hard.
That's right.
You want them to have to be equally challenged, to be equally frustrated, for them to sit down. Because I think these were college sophomores, and the test came from the graduate record exam, which is the thing you take when you want to go to graduate school. So
exactly.
The idea was you wanted it to be hard. So I guess what I'm still a little bit curious about is from what you believe is the case. For the black students, when they're sitting down and taking the test, it's designed to be hard, so they're having a hard time. They're frustrated. They're having a difficult time. Is it that they are sitting there, and as they have a hard time, thinking, man, there just must be something wrong with me, I'm not smart enough? Or is it that perhaps in addition to that, they're sitting there and thinking, you know, they think black students can't cut it, and here it is, I'm not cutting it. And if I don't, it's all it's going to do is people are going to come along and look at my performance and say, see, we knew that black students just couldn't cut it. So what it is, it's just an additional sort of stressor that they are putting on themselves because they're concerned that their performance is just going to go ahead and confirm what they know is a negative stereotype that's out there in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good description of it. It is the latter. We have some pretty direct evidence of that. This is not to say that students don't have self-doubts in this situation, because everybody does, and black students do too. But in addition to those self-doubts, what black students have, we know from, I won't describe all the details of how we get at this, but we know that cognitively their race and the stereotypes of their race are primed. They're on the... They're cognitively primed. They're available to them. So simply sitting down to take a difficult test like this is enough to prime race, make race something that they're aware of, at least semi-consciously, in this testing situation. And so it does become a kind of concern. Some people have described it as a trap, almost, that a rational person has to consider that if they are experiencing frustration and do badly on this test, that they might enable people to see them in racial terms and in terms of the stereotype. That performance, that frustration might enable that perception of them. And for people who really care about doing well in the domain, that possibility of being seen that way in a domain they care a great deal about is really upsetting. And our evidence suggests that's what's driving down the performance. Their blood pressure, for example, is elevated. They're trying very hard to do well on the test. They're trying almost extra hard, too hard, changing their answers, rereading the stem of the questions. So they're in there struggling, and then, you know, but you get the sense of someone wrestling with the prospect of how they're going to be seen and what their failure is going to be going to mean to them in their future at the same time that they're trying to do a test. And it just gets in the way.
And it's also interesting, again, to make the point about how this can cut and work so many different ways. I think also one of the things you did was you took some white students and you gave them a really hard math test. And some of them beforehand, you said to them, you know, Asian students do really well on these tests. And then some others, you didn't put that on them. And what you found was the same sort of thing happened. Those students where you said, you know, Asian students, they're superstars on this. They can just knock this out of the park. Those white students did less well than the white students who took the same test but didn't have that stuff. They didn't get that message beforehand.
Yeah, exactly. It's very important to show that this is a very general process that can happen to any group. And so white males are not a group about whom there is a negative stereotype about their math abilities. However, we could put them in a stereotype-threatening situation by putting them in the negative light of another group's positive stereotype, so to speak. Mm. So telling them that this is a test on which Asians do better than whites puts them in that situation. Again, this wouldn't happen for white males who don't care much about math, but we used in this study engineering students at Stanford, graduate students, were very concerned about doing well. And so the prospect of confirming this stereotype or being seen to confirm it was upsetting and undermined their performance.
And as well, you touched on this a little bit before, this kind of thing can work with gender as well, because there also has been some work done looking at women and how they do on math tests. And there the stereotype is, it's out there in the world as well, that somehow women aren't as... we know this is not true, but there's a stereotype that somehow women, when it comes to mathematics and science and those sorts of things, that they don't perform as well. Or perhaps what it is that the women are, they really want to show that women are every bit as good as men, and then they're taking that stressor into the situation with them.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. As I say, we really began with that research. Now it's been applied to a number of groups and performance domains. One cute study I was in the sports domain, where there was a golfing task, and they got elite athletes from the University of Arizona. And the golfing task, you had to golf 10 holes in a laboratory room, a little mini golf course there, and your score was just how many strokes it took you to get through this. And just before these athletes began to do this task, these were white and black elite athletes from Arizona. In one condition, the task was described as, this is a test of natural athletic ability. Well, there's a stereotype made relevant here that it favors black athletes over white athletes. And indeed, in that condition, black athletes outperform the white athletes. The tables were turned, however, when the same task, the same golfing task, was described in another condition as, this is a test of sports strategic intelligence. That's a stereotype in which that favors the white athletes over the black athletes, and indeed that's how the performance came out. The whites outperformed blacks under that condition. The threat there is on the black athlete. And when the other stereotype was made relevant, the threat of the stereotype was on the white athlete. And so it is, like, all of this evidence is to make the point that it seems to be a quite general phenomenon and process in life that can have quite consequential effects.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Claude Steele. He's professor of psychology at Stanford University. And this subject we've been talking about here this morning is a major research interest of his. He is here on the U of I campus to talk about some of this work. It's a lecture that's sponsored by the Department of Psychology. In fact, this is the Lyle Lanier Lecture. Has for a number of years taken place every year to honor a former head of the Department of Psychology, Lyle Lanier. This is, by the way, open to the public and free, and anyone who would like to hear more about this who's in and around Champaign-Urbana is welcome to attend. It'll take place tonight at 8 o'clock in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute on the U of I campus. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, we certainly know that stereotypes are pervasive and they are persistent. However, we also say we want all students, men, women, white, black, to do well, to excel and to perform to the best of their abilities. So now that we know how this operates, then I guess we have to ask, what do we do with this knowledge? How do we take this into the classroom?
I was afraid you'd ask that. this is really the main. This is the. I describe it. That question is the frontier of our current research. Is now that you know what the problem is, or at least what a significant part of the problem is, what can you do to improve that part of the problem? I can speak very generally and say that what we need to do are to create learning and schooling environments in which students feel what we're calling a kind of identity safety, a sense that their social identity, their gender, their race, is not going to be used as a basis of judging them, that the stereotypes about their identity is not going to be used as a basis of judging them. And I think when you think about it that way, you see how all of us can, we have, I almost think of this as an antenna that when we come into a situation detects whether our social identity, whether we're women, whether we're old, whether we're white males, whether we're minorities, that this antenna is out there detecting whether based on that social identity we're going to be seen in negative terms for some reason or treated in negative terms. We're very sensitive to that as a species, I think. And I think it's something we haven't recognized as much as we should, and we haven't therefore understood how the ordinary ways in which learning environments, for example, are organized can convey a sense of threat to people that in this particular situation, your identity as an African-American student or your identity as a white athlete trying to be a sprinter, for example, that your identity is going to pose problems for you in that people may judge you in a stereotype-driven way. And when you start to understand the world this way, you see that one of the important things that learning environments have to do in order to provide real educational opportunity, equal opportunity to get an education, is to make these environments relatively safe from that kind of threat. Because as long as I'm preoccupied with whether my social identity is going to put me under threat or lead me to be misinterpreted or to be held under suspicion or to be mistreated, if I'm kind of worried about that and vigilant to that, I'm distracted all the time. I've got this other issue going on in a situation that over time, of course, is going to alienate me in that situation and I think be the seeds of and is that process is where some of the underperformance of minority groups is coming from. So I think as a general answer to that question, we have to focus more on making environments safe where people feel that their social identities will be well respected and where it won't be a barrier to people seeing their potential and they're being taken in as someone who really has potential in that situation. And that's precisely what stereotypes can inadvertently interfere with. Think about how a white sprinter would be treated by the athletic establishment in our society. We have stereotypes about the distribution of sprinting ability among different groups in our society. And so you can imagine a white sprinter having good times, but coaches saying, well, you know, I don't know, maybe the wind was at his back when he did that time. And if he has a kind of mediocre performance, they say, yeah, that's kind of who he is. That's characteristic of who he is. And so he doesn't get into the best training program or environment, and he doesn't get exposure to other athletes that really know a lot about how to do that and are really motivated to become very, very fast. He's treated differently. The farther along he goes in this domain, the fewer and fewer other white sprinters he sees. And that reinforces his vulnerability to the stereotype that he might be seen in terms of this group-based stereotype. And so when you think about the world that way, you think in order to create equal opportunity in sprinting a performance, for example, we would have to pay some attention to how these stereotypes are affecting people. And I think that analogy holds for minority groups in school, for women as they go up the math ladder, up the ladder in quantitative fields, that we have to be aware that those environments convey a sense of threat to those people based on their social identity and the stereotypes about their social identity, and that for those environments to provide a real equal opportunity to learn and perform well, we're going to have to do things that make those students feel safe there. That's in a sense the easy answer. The hard answer is specifically, what actually do you have in mind? And this is where our research picks up the story. For example, one study we have, how does a white professor give critical feedback to a black student? I'll spare that the details of that study until later on tonight. But the answer is you use very high expectations, and at the same time you support the student's ability to meet those expectations. Simply giving feedback just giving it without any statement doesn't work. Black students are more likely to see that feedback as biased, and they're less likely to be motivated by it. If you precede the critical feedback by a sort of positive bromide, like, well, you're a wonderful person, I like your family, and all that, it won't work either. So powerful is a person's vigilance over the meaning of their race in that kind of situation, that just feedback like that has to be, almost by anybody who's rational, they have to consider the possibility that feedback could be coming from the stereotype as well as their work. And that's how race ambiguates a person's experience in school and isolates them from the value of feedback. But if you understand what you're dealing with, that you're trying to make that student feel safe from being seen stereotypically, then you develop the skills and teaching tactics that give feedback in ways that make it clear to them that they're not being seen stereotypically. The first thing is to hold them to high expectations. That tells them that you're not viewing them stereotypically. And then to directly affirm their ability to meet those expectations and to support them in the effort to do that. That shows them that their potential to succeed is not being interfered with by the stereotype about their groups. So that's an example of one technique. I'll enumerate more later on this evening.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Others are certainly welcome. Our guest is Claude Steele from Stanford University. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. Around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel, that's 800-222-9455. Caller here is local, line one. Hello.
Hi. Could you spell your last name for me? How many E's does it have in it?
Oh, it has three E's.
Three E's, okay. For somebody who can't come to hear you speak this evening, do you have suggestions for further reading?
I think probably the best overall piece is an article in the Atlantic Monthly in August 1999. Although there was an article in Newsweek just the week before the election, there was an article in Newsweek called "Stereotype Threat," Stereotype Trap, which reviewed a lot of this research, and I thought did a pretty good job. So I think in terms of getting very general overviews, those are two pieces that are useful.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. All right, and again, others are welcome to call 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. I wonder, you know, we've been talking about what can happen in educational settings and higher education inside the classroom to try to reduce the pressure of stereotype threat. I wonder, though, how much of this really has to do with other aspects of college life and life in that community that happen outside of the classroom, that, and that admittedly may or may not be something that college administrators can have any sort of control over. That's something I know they think about, mm-hmm. because the idea of attracting and retaining minority students is something that all colleges are making efforts to do. Mm-hmm. But how much of this really is not about what happens in the classroom?
That's a very good point, because the more we work on this, the more I'm just fascinated with the idea that a lot of this, that is a lot of the sense of threat I could feel about my social identity as a male or as an African-American, is coming from just the structure of the situation. A university like this one, if I'm an African-American, which I am, I come onto the campus as a freshman, and I immediately understand that I'm a member of a social minority. And that tells me, that's a fact, that tells me that identity I have is, I don't know what that means, you know, but it raises the question of whether it's going to be an identity, whether I'm going to be treated well, despite that being in that minority status. It's also the case that there's a sort of cultural hegemony. I know that's a loaded word these days, but there's a cultural hegemony in place, a sort of dominance in place that my own group is not that central to, that the tastes, the cultural strategies, ideas of my group are not that central to it. So I can feel that there's another basis on which my social identity could put me at some risk here. There's sort of a few ways of being smart on a campus like this that are tied to that cultural hegemony and don't completely overlap with all the ways that of being smart that I may be familiar with from my own community. There's race, the social identity that I have is used as a powerful organization of my social life and of my romantic life. Sometimes I think we forget how profound that is. But if for a black student to come onto a campus, immediately you recognize the importance of race and how your social life is going to be organized. It's in this society, it's still organized very substantially by race. And my romantic options are organized by race. So these are very profound personal things that signal to me that my identity as an African-American male means something in this environment, and I better watch out, be careful as to what it means. And there's a history in the United States, too, which also tells me that this identity may mean something. So I think we have to recognize that the sense of threat is not an irrational thing that people should just, in a colorblind world, give up and get over. And it's a real thing that anybody in that situation, a woman taking a math test or something, a white trying to be a sprinter, is going to feel. It has to be recognized as something that institutions have to deal with, which makes it all the more important, I would argue and I would think, to try to create niches. That's the best term I've been able to come up with, of identity safety in classrooms, in dormitories, to go at it that way, to recognize that the basic structure is bigger than can be changed by the simple will of an administrator. However, it's possible, with attention to the process, to create niches where people do feel identity safe. And the other hopeful thing here is that we often do in personal relationships. My own academic advisor was white and certainly had no great sophistication about race, but he was coming out for tenure and he really needed me. And so he was very responsive to me and very demanding. And I could just tell from that treatment that I wasn't being seen stereotypically. And in the context of that relationship, I relaxed and really engaged the profession and being trained to be a psychologist. So that was a simple thing that happened, even though the larger context was one which put me on vigilance about my identity.
Yeah, and it may, some of these to someone who hasn't experienced this may seem to be a small thing, but it does seem to be the case that black students often are very, very conscious of and very concerned about things that seem to be signifiers of blackness. How they dress, the kind of music they listen to, maybe what they like to eat, what they like to do in their off hours, all of those sorts of things. And depending upon the situation, they may be more or less willing to, in a sense, be themselves and be the person that they are, would do what they want to do, what they like to do, because they're also, again, very concerned about this, you know, how am I going to be seen? And if I genuinely love hip-hop music, is that okay for me to like that? Because, again, there's this stereotype threat operating, and, you know, do I really want people to think all black people really like hip-hop music? It's sort of odd that that should, you know, what kind of music you like to listen to should be an issue, but it indeed can be.
Yeah, it really can be taken as a... there's a story I often tell taken from Brent Staples' autobiography. Brent Staples is a black editorialist for the New York Times now, but he describes going to graduate school at the University of Chicago in Hyde Park and walking down the street dressed like a black student and being seen by people. People would sort of move out of his way, and when he went into shops, they would follow him around and so on. So he recognized that he was being seen through the lens of a stereotype as a potentially menacing black male. And he learned a tactic to prevent this in some situations, which was to go down the street whistling Vivaldi. I don't know exactly how you do that, but he did, apparently. And, you know, it was a behavior that was counter-stereotypic and made people around him not see him stereotypically. And not seeing him stereotypically, they relaxed because he wasn't the menacing black male they thought he might be. And he relaxed, and their relationships could get on. Well, I think black people, for example, and other groups dealing with stereotypes, we're often, contending with them, doing things that will put off other people seeing us stereotypically. And that it's a constant sort of ongoing feature of social life, that everybody does this. But if you're African-American in a situation like this, or if you're a woman in a math course, you're busy all the time, preoccupied, with presenting yourself in a way that isn't going to make you vulnerable to the negative stereotype about your group.
We have other callers. Let's talk with them. A couple of other local folks here. First, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Very fascinating discussion. I wanted to ask if we could apply your theory outside the academic arena. I'm particularly interested, I'm doing research on images of African Americans in film and television. And it seems to me that there are certain stereotypes about black women and men that have persisted since the days of, 1914 or whenever. For example, the mammy image or the dumb black male servant, how it seems that that figure or those two figures get repeated over and over again, even in contemporary television shows. But I'm wondering, I read a book called Stereotype Accuracy. You might be familiar with it, a collection of essays that talks about the extent to which some of these stereotypes are true, and that sometimes people, I want to focus primarily outside of academics, but, you know, people will see these images of minorities on the screen, and maybe they recognize, you know, something of themselves in the loud, sassy black female, or, you know, maybe not the butler, but America seems, well, I should say the media, the television and film, can't seem to let go of a certain portrayal of black women in particular. And I'm just struggling with this idea of the extent to which that is, I guess, accurate. I hate to use it, but that's the term I read about. You know, it's an accurate portrayal, but at the same time, there's so many large black women who aren't like Hattie McDaniel, or there's some large black women who aren't, you know, hot to trot and sexy, or who can't cook. You know, there's just all these images of women in particular that keeps getting repeated in contemporary shows. And I've talked to some women who say, well, yeah, I know people like that. It doesn't bother me. You know, and there are other women who are outraged. They say, well, you know, why can't we ever see a professional black female in a suit who doesn't put her hands on her hips and roll her neck, you know? I guess, I mean, I don't know if I formulated this question well, but it's just something I'm trying to struggle with in my own research, and I wondered if you had any comments on that.
Yeah, I just saw Bamboozled. Have you seen that movie?
Oh, yeah, I did.
It was a little rough in places, but I thought it certainly addressed this point. This is Spike Lee. Spike Lee's newest movie about precisely this image of the perseveration, I guess, of certain stereotypes, racial stereotypes, that just reemerge. And I didn't know it, but my son was quick to point out to me that the movie is, I guess, addressed at a television. station or network that has a lot of black shows on it that mm-hmm. really trade on kind of updated but still very old-time minstrelly type behaviors. And when you keep that in mind, the movie's a lot better, I think, than when you don't keep that in mind. But I have a great deal of sympathy with that. Also, the President's Commission on Race, I thought, didn't get much attention, and I thought it was misguided in some ways. But one of their conclusions I really strongly agreed with, which is that the perseveration of these stereotypes as almost a cultural devices for entertainment and for conveying information and so on is a real factor in American racial relations that we have to pay some serious attention to. Maybe there's an element of truth in some stereotypes. I always resist the idea that for every stereotype there's a grain of truth. That's not true. But there are sometimes some stereotypes that touch on a truth. Sometimes they exaggerate it, but they almost never tell the complete story.
Right. Okay.
Why would a woman behave that way? Mm. What's the circumstances she's dealing with? She's contending with. So I share your frustration with that. And there's also just the reality that when those stereotypes dominate and no other stereotypes are out, they kind of drive out. The bad drives out the good. You don't get any good imagery of the group, and it's very difficult to overcome that.
Yeah, I guess the thing is that some students or some people I've talked to say, well, there are women who have a personality. You know, it's personality that's very aggressive, very forceful, very, you know, vocal. And there are other women who are very soft-spoken and much more retiring. And so if a person has that kind of personality that's very aggressive and very bossy, should she be blamed for that, you know? I guess that's where I'm really struggling with this.
It's interesting. I mean, that kind of woman probably would, the loud, bossy woman, would deal with an element of stereotype threat in a lot of situations. It'd be frustrating for her to go into certain situations because she'd be afraid of confirming that stereotype, that racial stereotype. We should be allowed to have a sort of free range of personalities.
Yeah, that's it.
Should be a freedom of personalities, but there's going to be a cost to having that one.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to line number 3 for another caller. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I had a couple of questions. I often find myself struggling to fight against stereotypes, be they regarding gender or ethnicity. And I had a couple of questions. Does gender come out more than ethnicity or the other way around? And also have you done any studies on people of mixed ethnicities?
Those are good questions. I would say it whether to the, to your first one whether gender comes out more than ethnicity. It depends on the situation. I'm a social psychologist, and I think a lot about the effects that situations have on us as individuals, shaping how we behave. And I think certain situations are going to be loaded with the potential to see us one way or the other way. And sometimes it's going to be loaded to see us in terms of our gender. Sometimes it's going to be loaded to see us in terms of our ethnicity. Sometimes it's going to be loaded to see us in terms of our age. I'm getting a little older, and I'm increasingly aware of that. That in certain situations, you open your mouth and you're just seen as somebody who's older, who's speaking from an older world, a bygone era, and. So it depends a lot on the particular situation you're talking about. As to which stereotype is going to be the one most used to see you.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
And have you studied any effects towards people who are half one and half?
Oh yes, about we really haven't and. In the United States, around race, for example, there's still the kind of one drop rule. I'm reading a fascinating book on called One Drop of Blood, which is about that sort of history of the idea that if you have 1/16, one drop of black blood, you're black. And it, so even though you could be substantially more white than black, you are, in terms of inheritance, heredity, you're going to be seen socially as black. And as soon as people in your environment think of you as black, you're going to be subject to black stereotypes to some degree. They may be mellowed a bit by skin color, by degree of mixture, and so on. And there may be different ones that apply to people who are mixed in certain situations. So there will be particular stereotype threats attached to those kinds of identities. We just haven't gotten to the point of studying them yet.
I see. Okay, thank you very much.
One more quickly here in Champaign County, line four.
Hi, good morning. I wanted just to sort of get people to, and maybe you can comment on this, I don't know if this is where your research actually lied, but the depth of the stereotypes that are, the person earlier called about, TV stereotypes, but I happened to see an exhibit called White Over Black or something like that, at Wit und Black, Wit und Schwarz or something. It was in, I don't know if it ever traveled to the U.S., but it showed the legacy of European colonialism and how it formed the attitude. It also included the video Ethnic Notions, which I suggest as a remedy for people who can dismiss the weight of these stereotypes, because it's an excellent portrayal of you know, the last decades of in the early 20s and 30s, what media representations were like. Other than that, I don't, that sort of general thing, just the weight of the stereotypes, I can't help but ask if you're not related to that black conservative stereotype, Shelby Steele, because he's in the local reactionary paper we have here, he's featured quite a bit, and he's such a stereotype of himself.
He is my brother.
You mean that figuratively?
No, I mean that literally. We're brothers.
Aye.
Yeah. Yeah.
Must be an interesting Thanksgiving, though. I'll listen.
All right. Well, and we're at the point where, I'm sorry to say, we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Claude Steele, professor of psychology from Stanford, he'll be talking about this research tonight at 8 o'clock in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute. This is the Lyle Lanier Lecture. And as he mentioned also, if you can't attend or if you're interested in reading a good summary of this research, you can look at an article that he wrote that was published in the August 1999 edition of the Atlantic Monthly, and it is available on their website so that you can go there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Focus 580, our program, funded in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency. Programming on AM 580 also made possible by a grant from the Thrifty Nickel, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois. On the web at www.thriftynickel.com, the Thrifty Nickel, it's a good little paper. In the next part of Focus, we'll be talking with Andre Schifrin. He's founding director of the New Press. We'll talk about what's going on in publishing today. He's written about that in his recent book, The Business of Books. But right now, we have an update on the market, so please stay tuned.